This is KUT.
KUT, Austin.
Stop.
This is KUT. I'm Jennifer Staten. We live in a bumper sticker culture. That's how Austin author and Baylor University English professor Greg Garrett describes our discourse and dialogue these days. Not a very high mark, but you get what he means. Our competing bumper stickers shout to the world what we think without room for discussion or follow-up. So what can be done? Well, Garrett, who writes about religion and culture, teamed up with a longtime friend to model deep and civil dialogue on a variety of topics in a book called In Conversation, Rowan Williams and Greg Garrett. Williams is a Welsh Anglican bishop, theologian, and poet who was the 104th Archbishop of Canterbury. Garrett says he and Williams come from vastly different backgrounds, but that shouldn't hamper genuine discussion.
I think it is the thing we are lacking most in our culture, and certainly it's going on in the UK as well. And so Rowan was witness to that. So we've got the whole, for example, the Brexit conversation, the immigration conversation in the UK. And then for us, it's abortion, it's immigration, it's guns. And then just those huge divides that we can think of that are political or social or religious or cultural in some way. And the way I've been thinking about this is that in a very real sense, we all live in a bumper sticker culture. And so, like, I've got my bumper sticker, which it tells the world these are my positions, and I hold to these rigidly. And, you know, I'm going to park in the parking garage next to you and your bumper stickers, but there's not going to be any dialogue between them. They're just going to sort of shout at each other and remain in that space. And one of the things that we think is really important is this idea that even though you may come from radically different backgrounds, which Rowan and I do, you know, he is Baron Williams, and the first time I met him, he was living in Lambeth Palace, and I was living in a 400-square-foot efficiency apartment over a garage in Austin. And so there were some, you know, some differences between us and between our experiences, and yet the force of conversation is largely around the idea that however much we may differ in superficial ways, we all want the same things, and we all have reasons for the things we believe. And so ultimately, conversation is about coming back to respect, it's about listening, it's about a process, instead of conversion, which is what most conversation, and I'm putting like big air quotes around that, seems to be about these days. I'm right, you're wrong, listen to me and get it right.
But you do say, I think you note in the introduction, that you believe conversations do have a transformational power. What to you is that transformational power of conversation?
Well, you know, the transformational power of conversation is that willingness to believe that I don't know absolutely everything. And, you know, I've been teaching at Baylor for 30 years now, as you know. I talk a lot about how my students teach me things. And people think sometimes that that's sort of just a ridiculous kind of nice thing that I say. But that's absolutely true, because what I've done for the last 30 years is I've set up this venue for us to have conversations about things that matter, and literature or film or theology, those are the kind of inroads into that conversation about what it means to be human and what we care about. But if you take conversation seriously, and I mean, you and I have been having conversations for like 15 years now. What it means is that I am willing to listen to you and to be aware that as much as I may carry these opinions and these positions, I can learn something from you. And so there's not a day in class over the last 30 years where I have not learned something, because, I mean, there is this very real sense that I have heard something that I didn't know before. And in fact, Rowan Williams, in the afterword to our book, talks about there were a number of experiences in the 3 days of conversation that we did in Cambridge, where he was thinking to himself, and I'll do my Rowan Williams voice now, I didn't realize I knew this until we talked about it. And that's what conversation is when it works, is this recognition that through the exchange, you and I can learn something about each other and about ourselves. And even if it doesn't transform the beliefs that we have, You know, I could sit across the table from someone who holds an opposing position from me on gun control or abortion. My brother is a Southern Baptist pastor in Alabama, which is pretty diametrically opposed to where I am in virtually every way. But I also understand his humanity and his reasons for the opinions that he holds. And it allows me to think of him as human and not as somebody to be dismissed.
That quality of conversation also requires us to give up what you mentioned, which is that concept of, well, I'm right, you're wrong, and this conversation is ongoing to be me showing you that I'm right and you're wrong.
I was raised in a conservative evangelical home. The way that we thought about the world was that we had all the answers, and our job was to go out and tell the world our answers. And then when everybody shared our answers, I don't know, something good was going to happen. I don't know exactly what it was. And in a secular way, that's largely where we are now. So, what we think about our political candidates, what we think about our social issues, what we think about the end of Game of Thrones. It's, I'm right, you're wrong. If I yell loud enough or talk persuasively enough or blog enough, post enough on Twitter, the world will come to see things the way that I do. And it is really interesting because I think this is an ongoing process. I wrote a book back during the 2012 general election, and I think we talked about it here, where I said that I had this feeling that we were making decisions out of our confirmed opinions and not out of our belief systems, whatever those were. So if you're a devout Christian or Hindu or Buddhist or Muslim, often we were making decisions not about what we believed from our core, but from what other people told us that we ought to believe. And that gets reflected in the conversations that Rowan and I had. You know, I'm a lifelong Democrat and pretty serious about it. But if I make decisions largely out of Democrat dogma instead of out of my core beliefs, sometimes I find that they're in opposition to each other. Conversation helps me recognize that.
So I want to dive in a little to some of the topics that you all covered in
Please.
Your conversation. And you mentioned politics, so I'm going to have to go there, of course. So I want to actually pose a question to you that you pose in the book. And here's the question that you pose. What can people of faith do, particularly at a time when they don't feel like their political system answers to them?
Interestingly enough, you know, whether you're a liberal or a conservative, you don't feel like the system answers to you. And that's part of our discourse at this time, because we set ourselves up in this adversarial position, and we set ourselves up to believe in our victimhood. So if you're a conservative Christian, you believe, you know, the culture is stacked against me. And if you're a progressive person, you think, well, the system is stacked against me. And the hard thing about this, just in terms of conversation, is the recognition that we need each other in ways that we are not always willing to admit. There are, I don't know, 150 Democratic candidates right now. But what is really interesting to me in the process as we're starting to winnow these down and move toward whoever's going to stand in opposition to the president, assuming that he's still in office in the next election, is that there is this very real sense of, I'm going to pick the things that are really important to me, and I hope that they're important to you. But I am myself personally really drawn to those candidates that sort of open things up for conversation. And whether or not Beto O'Rourke ever gets out of single digits, one of the things that I particularly admire about him is his willingness to go into all sorts of places and listen to people. That is not something that gets done across the political spectrum. And I think it's also something that doesn't get done in religious traditions. And again, it's sort of this, we have our position and it is engraved in granite, and we're not going to move away from this. But what happens if we don't have actual conversation is that we just continue to see the other person as a person who is outside of our experience. And I think about some of the great conversations I've had in my life, this 3-day conversation with Rowan Williams and 15 years of conversation with him before him, all sorts of people I've met in my travels around the world. And I was thinking the other night about a young father that I spent the night talking to in Kenya. And this is like 20 years ago now, but we were sitting in his mud hut, his boma, in Western Kenya, and we were talking about the things that mattered to us. And although the sort of superficial and surface differences of our life could not have been more different, at the core, we wanted the exact same things out of life. You know, we wanted to live a life that mattered, where we felt useful. We wanted our kids to live in a world where they had more opportunities than we did. And I have never forgotten that, because, I mean, that is probably the most radically different set of circumstances in which I've ever been involved in a conversation. And yet, at the core, and this is what I think all of my years of teaching literature have taught me, is there's this universal human understanding of why we're here and what we're supposed to be doing. And we just break it out into our different sort of partisan ways, whether we think of it politically or religiously or culturally. And if we could talk about it and find our shared connections, and I don't mean to be naive, because I know it takes two to tango, and there have been plenty of times that I wanted to talk to people on the other side who didn't want to talk back. But if you can find people of good conscience, I think one of the most powerful things that can happen in our culture right now is for us to find that common space where we are all recognizing the common humanity we bear.
One thing that comes up in your conversation is, you say that it's important for everyone to have their story recognized and honored, and you say that there are political implications of this concept of everybody having their story recognized and honored. Talk a little bit about the political implications of that concept.
And that grew out of some conversations that Rowan and I had about Shakespeare and about great films and about great novels. And as a novelist, I can tell you, like, every character is the hero of their own story. And I remember writing a short story some years ago where the main character was going to a wedding. And, you know, traditionally we think, you know, the bride is the heroine of the wedding story. But really, everybody going to the wedding is the protagonist of their own story. You know, whether that's the bridegroom or, you know, the aunt or the whoever. Because we all sort of front and center ourselves and understand ourselves through our own human experience. And I think what happens when we fail to recognize that everybody is the hero of their own story is we diminish their humanity. So in the last presidential election, I had this very strong sense for a very long time. I don't get out of bed in the morning, and, you know, I'm not a paragon of human behavior. So there was a stretch where I was like, how can people think this? And then I started talking to people who thought this, including people in my own family. And even though I ended up disagreeing with them in terms of the substance of what they believed, I was able to understand exactly why they thought the way they thought. And so as a novelist, screenwriter, teacher of those things, I can tell you that every character has reasons for the things that they believe. They have motivations, they have a past, they have a present, there's a brokenness that they're responding to, there are desires that they have for this life. And so this idea that everybody is the main character in their story is just this recognition that people have reasons for what they do, even when we disagree with those reasons. And to fail to grant them that recognition is to diminish their humanity. And I love having those conversations with people. And I will tell you frankly, you know, I was talking about my brother, who's a Southern Baptist pastor in the Deep South. My mom she's Southern Baptist, and she is deeply conservative. And she loves our president in ways that I cannot get on board with. But she has reasons for that. One of the models that I've been thinking about as we've talked about this book is Thanksgiving dinner.
Which that must be interesting.
It's one of the few times in our lives. And, you know, I remember the New York Times running some stories about how to have conversation at Thanksgiving. You're there with your conservative relatives and your liberal relatives and your crazy socialist Uncle Phil. And if the turkey is going to get passed and the mashed potatoes are going to make it all the way around the table, you've got to find some way to have some discourse that honors everybody. And even if you say, you know, I don't believe that. And one of the things that my mom and I have been doing over the last couple of years, she will say something that comes out of her deeply held beliefs, and then she will pause for a second and she will say, I know you don't believe that. And that's an incredible recognition for her that has grown out of conversation. And I don't think she dismisses my belief. I don't think she thinks less of me. She has just come to this recognition that you and I don't think the same about this. And that's kind of a radical thing to say today.
One thing that strikes me about your conversation that you and Rowan have is, at least it comes across on paper, it is very civil. It is very amicable. You're sharing ideas very thoughtfully. What can you say for people, though, who either want to have or find themselves in conversations with people like you and your family where there is disagreement? Yeah. You know, there's not common ground. There may be mutual respect, love, affection, but or maybe not, but where there's not common ground.
I've been doing a lot of work over the last couple of years about reconciliation. And I just turned in a book for Oxford University Press on race and reconciliation. I am drawn back over and over again to the thoughts and teaching of James Baldwin, who is maybe the person that I'm thinking most about. Like, I've been carrying James Baldwin around in my he's right here on the table, actually.
I can attest to this. He's right there.
And what Baldwin said is, you have to love the person on the opposing side. And that is such an interesting choice of words. You have to love them. It doesn't mean like, by the way, because there are people with whom I have these arguments that I find it really hard to like them. But love is a larger, deeper, I mean, it's a spiritual calling. And even though Baldwin, you know, left behind organized religion early in his life, there was this very real sense that the spiritual cost of hating people was too much to bear. And, you know, you see it in religious teachings. Dr. Martin Luther King, who is one of my great teachers, talked about the importance of love. But what Baldwin is saying is that we all share the planet. And for us to be in opposing positions is just the spiritual corrosiveness of that will eat us alive. There are lots of spiritual teachings around this. But I come back to like a secular saying of this, which is from one of Cormac McCarthy's novels, where he talks about the person that you hate takes up residence in your house, and only forgiveness can expel them.
Wow, that's very powerful. I can't end our conversation without asking about something that really struck me in your conversation. So at one point, Rowan Williams says, and you agree with him, this phrase, to allow people to fail is the most humane thing we can do sometimes. Mm. Wow. What is that?
Well, I know that you're really interested in education, and you do the education podcast here at KUT. And Rowan and I are both educators. You know, he was Archbishop of Canterbury for 10 years, but before that he was a professor. You know, he was educated in Oxford and Cambridge. He's now the Master of Magdalen College at Cambridge. And, you know, my day job for 30 years has been as a professor at Baylor. And what both of us have observed over the last few decades is that our students are considerably less resilient than students were a couple of decades ago. And I think there are lots of reasons for that. But as I look at my students, I taught Harry Potter at Baylor in the spring. And I was looking around the classroom, and there was a lot of fragility. And some of it is emotional, some of it is mental. There is, you know, just in general in our society, a higher degree of diagnosed mental illness because we're much more open to talking about it now, which I think is a very good thing as somebody who has suffered from it. But there are a lot of our students who don't know how to fail. And, you know, I look at my own kids, I look at my students. Because in one way or another, our society has sort of buoyed them up and said, you know, you showed up and you will get a trophy. In the writing world, I can tell you, failure is a very real option. You can write a book and nobody wants it. You can write a book that gets published and nobody buys it. And so failure is not a friend of mine, but it's certainly certainly an acquaintance. There are so many powerful things that you learn from failure when you're allowed to do it in a safe space. And there's this sense that you are not diminished by this thing that you didn't accomplish. You are still a valuable person. And I think that is at the heart of what he's saying, because he's looking back. You know, after 10 years of being out of education, he came back into the teaching and administrative world and realized, you know, our students socially and culturally have been conditioned differently. And one of the things that I like about the conversation model is when you have conversation in a safe space, people can fail and survive it. It's like, okay, that was a bad idea. I take that back. Clearly, there is no support for that.
What for you, for this specific conversation, was the most valuable thing that you got from it? Either from a content perspective of what you all discuss, or just the very act of having the conversation?
You know, that is such a lovely question. I have been telling people that in some ways this book is a greatest hits album. Because Rowan Williams and I had these conversations about spiritual practice and about pop culture and about literature and about politics for over a decade. And we had been asked to come together and consciously do that so that people could follow the sort of threads that we explored together. But for me, the biggest thing is not professional, but personal. Rowan Williams is somebody who has become a very dear friend of mine and who has, you know, been involved in some of the great life decisions of my last 10 years. And to look at this and to see this sort of memorial of the work that we've done together, the conversations we've had together, the realizations that we've had together. I've told people this sort of feels like a lifetime achievement award. And I know I've got like 20 more books to write. But on the one hand, there's that. But on the other hand, it just sort of feels like this was an opportunity for me to talk to my friend, who also happens to be one of the smartest people that I know, and to have that memorialized so that other people could benefit from it.
Greg Garrett, we've been discussing In Conversation with Rowan Williams. Greg has written over 20 books of fiction, nonfiction, and memoir. He's an English professor at Baylor University and is theologian in residence at the American Cathedral in Paris. Greg, as always, thank you for your conversation.
You're welcome, Jennifer. Always a pleasure.